This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a proposition is before the voters of California that might dramatically reduce the state's prison population. And students at Philadelphia's Temple University organize their own lecture series in Black American history. But first, Pennsylvania's governor is set to sign a bill that's designed to silence the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal and other prisoners of America's vast incarceration system. Police organizations were angered that Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, was allowed to give a commencement speech to students at Goddard College in Vermont, where he had earlier earned a degree while still on death row. The state legislature would curtail the right to free speech by prisoners on the grounds that it might cause mental anguish to the families of victims. Dr. Johanna Fernandez is a professor of history at New York's Baruch College and a longtime supporter of Mumia Abu-Jamal. She says the bill is unlawful and dangerous.
It's a backlash. It's a repressive law silencing the rights of prisoners to speak. And in my opinion, I think it suggests that authority, the police, the prisons are feeling the heat of emerging movements against police brutality in Ferguson and across the country, but also they're feeling the heat of an emerging movement against mass incarceration. And so this law, in silencing prisoners and those who amplify the speech and messages of prisoners on the outside, is clearly an attack against these movements, against Black criminalization across the country. And of course, they've used Mumia, who's the most visible person within the prisons, precisely because he has made it his job to analyze the crisis of incarceration, the problems in the world, and to essentially give voice to the voiceless. So this is really a move that's about silencing dissent and silencing the aspirations and the articulation of grievances of people at the bottom of society.
The world has come to know Mumia Abu-Jamal over these last 30-plus years, not just because of the grassroots movement in his defense that grew up, but because of his writings and his speech. Is all of this threatened by this legislation?
Absolutely. What the legislation allows is for suits and injunctions to be presented in court by DAs and by the general attorney against Mumia and against other prisoners if it is believed that the speech of Mumia creates anguish in the victims' families. So absolutely, what we imagine is going to happen is that the wife of the slain officer, Officer Faulkner, the officer that was killed on December 9th, 1981, and this is the crime for which Mumia was sentenced to death, she will likely, in collaboration with the DA and the Attorney General in Pennsylvania, go to court in order to silence Mumia. And at risk at this moment are Mumia's writings, but also Mumia's regular commentaries on prison radio. Another issue that is in the cards is the fact that Mumia has now been projected at public meetings via conference call. So people who facilitate calls at public meetings are also liable. Prison radio is liable, and individuals who facilitate Mumia's speech, but the speech of other prisoners in any way, and their writings and publications could be removed from the public domain.
So in a sense, the writings and speech of prisoners could become a kind of illegal
contraband product if possessed by people on the outside of prison.
Absolutely. And the issue you raise is hugely important. This is really about silencing speech, not just among prisoners, but on the outside. This is really an example of how injustice in one place is injustice every place, because everyone is potentially going to be accused or can be accused of contraband and of disseminating information and ideas that are illegal.
Again, this seems to be a new category of law which focuses not necessarily on just what is said, but on who says it.
Oh, yes. And when that voice, the voice of Mumia and the voice of people at the bottom of society, the imprisoned, those who understand better than others the naked power of the state, when those voices like Mumia are challenging the organization of society, are consistently pointing to the structural problems within capitalism that produce racism and inequality, those voices are dangerous. And let me give you a sense of how dangerous the state believes they are. Mumia called into Ferguson last Sunday to the hip hop and resistance concert, which was held in St. Louis. It was held at a venue that was filled to capacity at 500, and it was filled with mainly young people from Ferguson and St. Louis that have been involved in protest. Mumia opened the event with a statement, and what we heard in the aftermath of his statement was a huge roar from people who wondered who this person was and why he was imprisoned. And essentially, the danger in Mumia's message is that he's connecting the crisis of police violence and police execution in the streets of Ferguson with the project of warehousing the poor who are disproportionately black in this country, in America's prisons. His voice and his message embody the connection between Ferguson and the crisis of incarceration in the United States. And Mumia ties that to a crisis of capitalism and to the inability of capitalism to really meet the needs of ordinary human beings. That's a very dangerous connection. And that's precisely the connection that the state, the Fraternal Order of Police, want to prevent. So that's really what's behind this law. And I'll just say another thing. You probably know, and your listeners know, that recently a judge ordered that Sundiata Okoli, the political prisoner Sundiata Okoli, be released. And as you know, this is a case of the state of New Jersey, which is next door to Pennsylvania, which is the state that is housing Mumia in prison right now. The last thing the state of Pennsylvania wants is for that current of freedom that we see developing in Sundiata Okoli's case to spread to the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Why? Because Mumia's case is known internationally, it's known nationally, and it's riddled with police corruption, malfeasance, but also with the collaboration of the DA and high-profile Democratic politicians and judges in Pennsylvania, like former governor and DA Rendell. If there is a crack in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, political heads are going to roll, and there is going to be a crisis of legitimacy in Philadelphia, in the power of the police, but in the political apparatus that's going to have huge ramifications for a conversation around political imprisonment, but also around the crisis of mass incarceration. So the stakes are very high in this case, which is the reason why Pennsylvania the Fraternal Order of Police and its political allies have essentially rolled out a gag order against Mumia, but also against prisoners who are increasingly protesting their condition of imprisonment, the violations that are systemic in the courts, but also the horrific, inhumane, and torturous conditions under which many prisoners are housed in solitary confinement, for example. So this is really a serious law that threatens the very notion of democracy on which this nation was built, this First Amendment right to free speech.
It seems that the latest impetus for this law was the outrage that police organizations around the country felt in not being able to prevent Mumia from speaking to Goddard College in Vermont recently. In that speech, Mumia didn't make references to his own case, and yet the DA would allege that that still caused mental anguish to the cop's wife. I suppose that the fact that Mumia is alive causes mental anguish to lots of people.
That's exactly right. I think really that this is not about mental anguish. This is really about a struggle over power and over the truth in this case. And the fact is that the movement to free Mumia Abu-Jamal has scored quite a number of victories. For one, we stopped the state from executing Mumia in the 1990s, and most recently in 2011, through struggle, Mumia's death sentence was overthrown. And he's now in general population. He's still serving a life sentence without parole, so it's a half victory, but it's a victory nonetheless. But the issue is that the Fraternal Order of Police and its allies were not able to get their way. And in fact, Mumia has more access now to the airwaves. And you're absolutely right. Mumia is an important symbol of justice because he has dedicated his life not to his case, but to consistently writing about injustice the world over. And that is, again, threatening. That is threatening in this case because Mumia does capture the imagination of people who listen to him. And also because, again, if there is a break in this case, a lot of people are going to be embroiled in a pretty serious political crisis that could potentially lead to prosecutors and politicians and police officers losing their jobs.
And on October 22nd, there will be a response in the streets.
There will be a response in the streets. We will have a press conference in Philadelphia at 10 a.m. on October 22nd, which, as your listeners know, is a National Day of Action Against Mass Incarceration. We will also have a honk against the bill at 4 p.m., and we will have a town hall meeting at approximately 7 p.m. to really strategize on how to defeat this bill. People should go to bringmumiahome.com or they should email bringmumiahome@gmail.com for more information. We're in the process of figuring out the details of this day of action in Philadelphia, but there will be caravans from New York going to Philadelphia on October 22nd. And if people can't make all of the events, they should at least try to make one of the events, either the press conference at 10 a.m., the honk against the bill at 4 p.m., or the town hall meeting at 7 p.m.
And we can at least hope that Mumia's voice might be heard at that event.
Absolutely. Mumia will likely call in. We had a conversation, and Mumia happened to call me, and I patched him in to the meeting. And part of what he said was that this offers a platform on which to fight not just around his case, but around the lie that is the American Constitution, because we think in this country that we have rights that are protected, but what is happening throughout the nation in all kinds of realms of life is that our rights are being eroded. We saw that in the Patriot Act. We see that in the activities of the NSA and the heavy surveillance under which American citizens live day in and day out. We saw that in Citizens United, which gives corporate entities the rights of individuals, forsaking the rights of citizens. So this is really a moment in the United States in which the state is on the offensive to take back the gains of the civil rights and Black Power movements and to really assert its power in a really rogue way. I personally think that it's a sign of its desperation and of its weakness, and a sign that the state knows that movements are on the ascendance, that we are at the beginning of a period of mass rebellion and social movements against the intransigence of the state and corporations, and it's sharpening its tools of repression to silence the dissent that we have already begun to see brilliantly in Ferguson.
Professor Johanna Fernandez of Baruch College. At Frackville State Prison in Pennsylvania, Mumia Abu-Jamal had this reaction to the bill that would silence his voice.
I welcome Governor Corbett's signature on an unconstitutional bill that proves that the government of Pennsylvania, the executive and the legislature don't give one whit about their own constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, nor the United States Constitution. I welcome that because it proves that they are the outlaws.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal. This Wednesday marks the high point of a month of national protest against the U.S. criminal justice system. We spoke with Carl Dix, a co-founder, along with Dr. Cornell West, of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Both Dix and West were arrested during recent protests in Ferguson and St. Louis, Missouri.
The month of resistance to mass incarceration decided that we had to stand with the people in Ferguson and respond to the call for Ferguson October. So we took a delegation of folks down, myself, other members of the steering committee for the month of resistance, Afia Wangaza from South Carolina, Alita Alston Ture from Jacksonville, Florida, Colette Flanagan from Dallas. And we were there to join people in the call for justice for Michael Brown and the call for no more police murder of Black and Latino youth all across the country, but also to link that to the growing nationwide movement of resistance that's targeting all of the horrors of the criminal injustice system of this country. And it was really a powerful outpouring of resistance. The folks from Ferguson, especially the young people, were right at the forefront of it. And they took things all over the Ferguson-St. Louis area there. We were marching in the streets in St. Louis, laying siege to the Ferguson Police Department, going into the Shaw neighborhood where police had recently murdered Von Derrick Myers. The young folks then went on a very mobile mission. They shut down three Walmarts in one day in solidarity with the struggle for justice for John Crawford, who police murdered in a Walmart in Ohio. And then they even stormed into the casino down there in St. Louis, the Hollywood Casino, as well as going to the Monday night football game and dropping a banner across the scoreboard. So, I mean, they were seeing to it that no corner of that area wasn't going to be impacted by the struggle against police murder of Black people.
It seems that we may have reached a watershed moment around the issues of police brutality and murder and mass incarceration. And apparently the authorities fear that we've reached that watershed moment as well. We hear words like outside agitators referring to people like you and conference calls between the FBI and police departments all around the country aimed at keeping track of all these outside agitators.
Yeah, and see, people need to be clear what it means when they start talking about outside agitators, because they're picking up the terminology of George Wallace, Bull Connor, and the like, in saying that our good, well, they didn't call them black people, then they called them something else, but our good Negro people who we keep down here, they know their place and they would not stand up. It must be these outsiders coming in, these radicals, these revolutionaries, these communists who are stirring it up. And the point to throwing the charge outside agitator is to divide the movement that's standing up to transform the status quo. So when you start picking up that term, that's what you're doing. You're actually siding with the people who want to maintain the status quo. Look, I came from outside of the Ferguson area, but I did not come from outside the struggle against police murder and police brutality. I've been involved in that struggle for decades now, and there's nowhere in this country that you're going to be outside that struggle, because it is a nationwide epidemic and it requires a nationwide movement of resistance. And that's something that the month of resistance to mass incarceration, which is October, is on now. It's about half over, but we got a lot more to go, including the very important October 22nd National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality. But nobody's an outsider in this struggle. The question is, are you standing on the right side of this struggle?
Well, is this really a watershed moment? We see Ferguson, St. Louis, appearing as a kind of mecca for movement people from around the country coming together.
Well, it's a potentially watershed moment, because what the response of the people in Ferguson did is they took something that happens too often, and that is police murdering black youth, and they made it a focal point where everybody all across the country had to confront that, had to look at it, could no longer deny that it was happening because of the heroic resistance of people in Ferguson. And now the question is, what side are you going to stand on, and are you going to continue to build this resistance? And a cry is emanating out of Ferguson. It was first voiced from the stage on the rally Saturday, October 11th. When the rapper Tef Po said, when we leave here, you ain't going home to watch your garden grow, to clip your toenails. We're leaving here and going to take up the October 22nd National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality, which was something I had gone down there to spread, but some folks down there were already spreading it. So we are moving now to make this October 22nd, which will be the 19th annual National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation, the most powerful October 22nd ever. Because October 22nd has historically been a day when those who suffer under the billy clubs and guns of brutal murdering cops have a platform to speak of the devastation that that brutality and that murder has inflicted on their lives, and people from many other backgrounds are called upon to join them, to stand with them, to have their backs in this struggle. We're going to be doing the same this year, and like I said, it's going to be everywhere across the country. When we went down to Ferguson, there were 30 areas that had plans to mark October 22nd, and that's a number that's growing right now. And everybody who hears this needs to join in on it. October 22nd, that's the day. Go to the website, stopmassincarceration.net. You can look through the list of areas that already have plans and find out what's happening in your area. If you look through the list and your area ain't on there yet, plan something. Get together with the people you work with, the people you go to school with, the people in your neighborhood, and act, stand up to say no more to police murder. And when you do that, send in the information of what you do. Take some pictures. Get your cell phone out and take video of it. send that in, and we will post that up on the website so that everybody across the country can see what everybody else is doing and how this is going. And in this way, it can serve as a springboard for taking the movement farther, because October was the month to make a big leap, but the point to making the big leap wasn't to stop where we get to by the end of October, but to continue advancing, continuing to leap forward from there.
And none of this is, of course, contingent upon whether a grand jury indicts the cop who shot down Michael Brown or not.
Yes, well, see, this is a very important point to get. We're fighting for justice for Michael Brown. That cop, Darren Wilson, should have been arrested and indicted on the spot. I mean, the murder happened. The guy got shot. He was unarmed. He was running away trying to save his life. He had his hands up. There are many witnesses who have testified to that. And the whole thing of having a long, drawn-out grand jury, it's an attempt to cover this up. So we have to stand up and demand justice. Whichever way the grand jury comes back, there's a call to be in the streets the next day. If they come back with an exoneration of the cop, the struggle still has to continue, because that means, again, this system has let a murderer go loose. The Federal Justice Department is running an investigation, but I don't put any store or hope in that, because I've seen this dance too many times. You know, the local authorities, who are very adept at running Black and Latino people, especially young people, into jail for astronomical penalties for very minor violations and sometimes no violations at all of a sudden forget how to prosecute when the person is supposed to be prosecuting is a killer or a brutal cop. And then the Justice Department comes in and says, don't worry, we're going to investigate it. And then they drag it out another year or two and then drop the thing. So we're not thinking that the system is going to take care of this. We have to be going at it, that it is up to us to stand up and say no more to this. And whatever grand juries, prosecutors, Department of Justice says, whatever they say, we say that police murdering our youth has gone on for too long. It is illegitimate, immoral, and unacceptable. It must stop. It must stop now. And we are acting to stop it. And we call on everybody with an ounce of justice in their heart to join us in that fight. And October 22nd is the next step.
Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, speaking from New York. The people of California will have a chance next month to vote on Proposition 47, a ballot measure that would reclassify six nonviolent crimes that are now felonies and turn them into misdemeanors. The measure would also transfer state funds that are now spent on prisons into programs that would transition people back into civilian life. The internet-based activist organization Color of Change has thrown its weight behind Proposition 47. We asked Matt Nelson, the group's organizing director, how many prisoners might be affected.
The numbers are still can be determined once it's passed, but it could impact up to 10,000 people who are currently incarcerated. And then, of course, the amount of folks who come into the system, around 40,000 annually, who are currently, because of the way that the state overcharges and overcriminalizes, particularly Black Californians, this will affect tens of thousands of people each year who, if these laws are changed, won't be caught up in this particular dead end of over-incarceration, overcharging. And so it will immediately affect people who are currently locked up, and then will affect those who would otherwise be caught in very harsh and long sentences unnecessarily.
You use that word, that term, overcharging. That's a term that's usually associated with paying too high a price for something in the marketplace, at a store or someplace else. But what is the cost of overcharging in the criminal justice system?
Right, and it's over policing, over surveillance, over stopping, over arresting. One of the really important things I think that's at stake related to Proposition 47 is that can actually change the acceptance of the massive prison system that we have, and that will make it unacceptable to have such high rates of incarceration, which really start in a racially biased culture that criminalizes particularly black youth, which infects how law enforcement acts and how law enforcement treats people. Most youth of color get stopped by police on a regular basis just for being who they are, or just for being a black child on the street, or going to their home, or going to and from school. And so it starts with a over-policing that then leads to wrongful charges for different reasons, including, you know, officers needing to justify the harassment by then charging people, and then having, once folks get in the system, it's kind of hard to get out. And so overcharging is just one part of the unjust targeting of communities by police. And then the other side of that is that there's very little accountability for those police officers. So the issue around massive prison overcrowding and mass incarceration relates directly to the over-policing of communities of color.
Of the way the system exists now, the classification of offenses as felonies or misdemeanors is up to the police and, even more importantly, the prosecutors. How would Proposition 47 take away that kind of arbitrariness?
It would restrict DAs and police from seeing lower-level offenses as felonies, knowing that they wouldn't be able to prosecute those offenses as felonies. The stigma around a felony is also something that this would help alleviate, because in many cases, being labeled a felon, even for what in California, very low-level nonviolent drug offenses or nonviolent property offenses, can follow you the rest of your life. And it also, removing felony classifications reduces the power of police to prosecutors, the criminal justice system, and I think in many ways public perception, to then write off people who are charged and convicted as with felonies. It allows for opportunity where people can not just be trapped in the criminal justice system, but be able to go to alternatives to incarceration, to diversion, basically to be treated with a higher level of dignity and not just instantly being written off as a criminal or a felon like so many are.
Are there mechanisms in Proposition 47, in the Act, that would ensure that the police and the prosecutors actually follow the spirit and the language of the Act?
I think that's where the funds transfer comes into place. And so this will actually remove $1 billion from the prison system, from the locking up system, and put it back into substance abuse and mental health treatment and different education programs. And so a lot of folks within the system are motivated by where the money's going. And so if the money's moving away from incarceration toward support and rehabilitation programs, that's also where that will have accountability in it.
In other words, if there's no place to divert people to, then there's less of an incentive to go along with the spirit of the Act.
It gives options too. So the only option will no longer be to arrest, overcharge, and over-incarcerate. You know, there will be money taken away from the prison system and put into alternatives.
For 3 years, until there was a slight increase in the prison population last year, there was a slight decrease in the overall prison population in the United States. And that was largely due to declines, big declines in prison population in three states, New York, New Jersey, and California, that forced California in particular to conform to constitutional norms of imprisonment. Proposition 47, would it result in California jumping to the lead in decarceration, as people are calling it now, and by doing it by legislation rather than random court order. Is that a better way to go?
Yeah, I think so. And I think this will hopefully bring California more in line with the court order, more in line with an actual plan to reduce the population and change the agenda. So this can really change the agenda that has been overly focused on harshly locking anyone up that gets caught in the system for low-level offenses. Proposition 47 will fight back against this endorsement that has previously been given to target communities of color. And I think it speaks to a process for decarceration, which I think is really important to go a legislative route and to lay out a clear deprioritization of locking people up and a better resourced system of alternatives to make it clear that the public has a say and a role in how the system operates and can make it better. And that if passed, it'll send a clear message that this is a way that California wants to go. And I think the other thing that this could do is show a much better alternative than what we've seen from Governor Brown in recent months, which has been a focus on increasing private prisons in the state. And so, yes, decarceration is happening, and it can happen in a sound way that's good for the public. But if it doesn't pass, if Proposition 47 doesn't pass, I think it'll open the door for more avenues for the private prison industry to say that they can be the solution, that private prisons can be the solution to overcrowding, which is very dangerous.
Well, Proposition 47 is out there. What's the strategy for getting it passed?
I mean, it's doing very well, and it's polling well. There's a lot of energy behind it. And our view is, and the reason why we went out to our California members is because we think that it has to pass strongly, and it has to pass with a lot of people participating beyond the ballot. So, yes, people should come out and support the proposition. I think that these propositions are also a way to engage voters that maybe aren't so engaged or maybe aren't so inspired by a particular political candidate, but can see the way in which this really matters. But we'll need people beyond the election to actually fight for the budget and fight to make sure that once the money comes out of incarceration, that it goes to good programs and it doesn't go back to other truancy programs that can criminalize youth. So I think it's really important that this vote carries a mandate beyond the letter of the law, that it really carries a mandate for a change in agenda, a change in perspective, and a change in the culture that's created this criminal justice system up to this point.
Matt Nelson of Color of Change. In Benton Harbor, Michigan, community leader Reverend Edward Pinckney faces trial on October 27th on charges of altering signatures on a petition to recall the current mayor. Reverend Pinckney says he's being railroaded by the giant Whirlpool Corporation, which has long dominated the politics of the mostly black city. Reverend Pinckney has faced similar charges in the past and beaten them. We asked if he's expecting anything different this time around.
Absolutely not. Matter of fact, they basically have nothing. They're counting on an all-white jury that is motivated by something other than the truth. And here in Barron County, we have a major, major issue when it comes to black against white or white against black, whatever it is. They normally try to, with no evidence. Let me give you an example. There was a young man that was sent to prison for 45 years for ecstasy that he did not have. All white jury. Amazing. But here I am going up against these people. And I'm very, very confident if I can get my witnesses to court, it's a battle. It's a battle. If I get my witnesses to court, I win. They don't show up, it's up for grabs.
Well, what is the truth of the matter in this case in which you're charged with voter fraud of a kind?
Well, here's what I believe happened. They was willing to do anything to stop this election. The mayor of James Hightower. We call them Lowtower, but they were willing to do anything. I believe they would even kill to keep him in office because he is the corporate puppet.
Even if you prevail in court on Monday, on October 27th, you've still been made to pay a heavy price in this case.
Absolutely. What I have been made to pay is already I'm paid $25,000 to this lawyer, knowing I don't have it. Matter of fact, I saw him this morning. First thing came out of his mouth was, look, we need more money. So without the trial itself, we're hitting close to $50,000. Plus, I was under house arrest. I could not use a computer. My wife could not use a computer. Matter of fact, we couldn't even have a computer, the internet, in our home. And then I was under 24/7 for house arrest. And then we always had some officer driving up and down the street trying to find out what I'm doing. So it's always been something. That's why I must prevail on this, because they're going for the throat.
So all they have to do to tie up the movement that you lead in your city is just bring a charge, and that causes all kinds of financial and other problems for you and your leadership.
Absolutely. That's the whole game plan. Matter of fact, they use that same game plan around the country. You see, if they can neutralize the leader, they can neutralize the whole movement, you know, and they would do anything. You see, here's a lot of people don't understand. They would do anything to preserve that ties between the corporations and government itself. And both of them works against the people. They would do anything to keep things from happening, keeping you from finding out what's going on. Right now, here in the city of Benton Harbor, they're about to steal 22 acres of our beach because there's no resistance other than Reverend Pinckney.
There are no jobs in Benton Harbor. There used to be. About all the black folks have is that beach.
That's it. That's the only thing they have left here. Nothing else worth money do they have. We have land, but it's more like trees and stuff on. But I know how they know how to work it. But they know what they're doing. They know how to take over. And you can expand Benton Harbor, but you can't expand none of the other communities around here. This is why they are targeting the city of Benton Harbor. Even with this emergency manager, we got rid of two of them. Now we got four. They can make a decision to cancel anything that the elected body say or do.
So this mayor that you want to recall actually has no power anyway.
Well, the only thing he has is the name. And this is what corporations use. They use the name of individuals to get things done. The mayor, the commissioner, the elected body. This is what they use in order to let people know that the city of Benton Harbor is supporting what they're doing. These 22 acres, the mayor supports it, rather than saying the people support it.
Benton Harbor's population is dropping. Do you think that the Whirlpool Corporation's plan is, in general, working to clear black folks out of the area and make it into another kind of city?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, we're down to less than 10,000 people living here in the city of Benton Harbor, and at one time we had over 40,000. So we're at 25% of what we normally had. So I do see that whatever plan that they're putting into operation is working.
What do you expect to happen on October 27th?
Well, I expect them to present the evidence, and I expect the jury to say not guilty on all counts, because I'm planning on beating them down like never before.
Reverend Edward Pinckney in Benton Harbor, Michigan. A series of lectures begins this week in Philadelphia based on the works of the great African-American scholar and political activist W.E.B. Du Bois. In previous years, the Du Bois lectures were presented by Dr. Anthony Montero, the veteran professor of African-American studies at Temple University. But this year, students have had to organize the lectures on their own. Dr. Montero's contract was terminated by Department Chairman Molefi Asante, who has since decided to change the name to the Department of Africology. Sabrina Sample is a student of African American Studies and a leading campus organizer at Temple.
Well, I think that the students who have been most affected by Dr. Montero's absence have really been rallying behind this lecture series cause and just, you know, attending the lecture series and also getting the word out around campus that the lecture series is going to be taking place. just to supplement the education that we're getting in the College of Liberal Arts in general and the Department of African American Studies. So that's what we've been doing, just seeking out different ways to get back on the campus.
Well, it really says a lot that you feel that you have to supplement what's offered by the college at this stage.
Certainly, certainly. We just feel as though just a critical analysis of certain things, you know, historically and politically, economically even, just through the vantage point of the African-American struggle is lacking. And that's typically what many of us feel we were getting in African-American studies before Dr. Montero's contract was not re-signed. We felt like we were getting that kind of critical analysis through the African-American tradition of struggle, looking at a lot of these different systems of capitalism, of white supremacy, and, you know, so on and so forth. But it seems like with the absence of Dr. Montero in the African-American Studies Department, that the shift toward what Dr. Fonson would call Africology, or just that African-centered education, is really just stripping the African-American tradition of struggle, which has a large history and definitely resonates more so with a lot of, you know, us African-Americans who are of the continent and, you know, of this culture and have a different understanding of the world in that way.
Now, it was only early last year that there was a huge struggle at Temple about the character, the nature, and the integrity of the African American Studies Department. And folks on campus felt that they won, but it's a different story today.
Certainly it is. You know, the struggle began with the students, both graduate students and undergraduate students, having rallies and just trying to raise consciousness around the campus about a white woman being the chairperson of the African American Studies Department. Temple University has a historic African American Studies Department, with one of the first departments, or the first department, to offer a PhD in AFAM studies. And so we felt that, you know, having a white person as the chair would totally just make, you know, our studies unauthentic, and was part of just the whole neoliberal campaign to just strip away critical thinking in the academy, especially when it comes to the humanities and social science. So we wanted to take that first step in just making sure that we had control over, that the students had a say, and that the professors that we, you know, look up to had a say in what was going on in the department. And so we were successful in putting pressure, you know, through rallies and things like that. They got a lot of media attention, putting pressure on the administration, sorry, the president of the university, and also the College of Liberal Arts, Teresa Soufis. We're able to put enough pressure on these individuals to where, though, we got Dr. Malefe Asante appointed as the chairperson, and we did feel that we had won after that struggle had ended. But we saw in the semesters that followed that Dr. Asante had a different agenda than what the students had anticipated. And that agenda was to, you know, eliminate any competition for Afrocentric ideology within the department.
And now it's not even called, or it's about to not be called, the African American Studies Department, but a Department of Africology.
And that just goes along with his campaigns. I mean, a man writes 80 books on the same topic, and it goes without saying, it's not surprising that he would like to pretty much remake the department in his own image and his own ideology, sort of as a crusade of just his own self, rather than continuing on the rich tradition of both Afrocentric ideologies and African-American ideologies, but pretty much trying to purge the department of any kind of competition for Afrocentricity. And making it Africology is symbolic. It's a symbolic change, but I feel as though it's a big insult to a lot of the students who signed on and became majors and minors in African-American studies and will now be graduating with majors and minors in something quite different.
And not only has Professor Montero been purged, but effectively W.E.B. Du Bois, one of the greatest thinkers of the 20th century, seems to have been purged from the curriculum, so that the students have to hold lecture series on Du Boisian studies on their own.
For sure. Du Bois has been purged, which is an insult to academia in and of itself, just the father of modern social science, somebody with a nearly 100-year lifespan across some of the most important contemporary movements of Black American Black history, somebody who's seen it all, done it all, and has committed his life to the study of black folk throughout the diaspora, but concentrated in the United States. Dr. Montero was, you know, one of the leading Du Boisian scholars, and he always makes sure to convey the importance of Du Bois. And Dr. Montero will tell you that, you know, reading Souls of Black Folk in any other class, I've had classes where I've had to read Souls of Black Folk and different works from Du Bois outside of African-American studies, and the experience is totally and completely different. When you're looking at these things from the lens of African-American struggle and you're engaging Du Bois, I think it really pushes scholars to go in that Du Boisian tradition of not being separated from the things that you study, which goes right along with just the accountability to the community, because what Du Bois teaches us through his actions and through his work, along with through his ideology, that when you are committed to studying a certain group of people, that you are of that people and not just, you know, studying an object.
In addition to studying Du Bois on your own, are there any plans afoot for direct action?
I think that the Student Coalition, specifically that the lecture series has been sponsored by the People's Underground for Revolutionary Progress and other student groups like the Temple Democratic Socialists. I think that if there's one thing that the administration knows is that we are a coalition of students who are committed to direct action, and that in the semesters, you know, prior to this semester, we've been out on the campus demonstrating, and that we will continue doing that thing. I guess right now what we want to do is concentrate on this consciousness raising and getting people to come out to the lecture series. But we are never afraid or never opposed to direct action, even though direct action hasn't really been planned for the, you know, upcoming, you know, months or weeks. But we just want to see how these things transpire. But it just, it seems like the only thing that the university does respond to is a show of force. And I think that that show of force must be in the form of direct action.
Your chairperson of PERP, that's the People's Underground Revolutionary Progress, how active is it at Temple?
We started out of Temple University. It's an organization that began out of the struggle to save Black studies when we were trying to get Malefe Asante appointed as the chairperson. So that's where our roots are at Temple University. But as far as us being active on the campus, we collaborate with a lot of different student organizations like the Temple Democratic Socialists, the Black Student Union there at Temple. The members of our organization are members of these other organizations that are on campus. But being as though we are, you know, as our name says, a more underground organization, we're also citywide. We don't limit ourselves to Temple University's campus because, you know, a lot of people like to limit their activism to a college campus, which could be a microcosm of a larger system that's going on. But what we do is we act in the North Philadelphia area, West Philadelphia, and different areas. And what we primarily do is we sponsor protests or demonstrations so that they are very visible, you know, around issues like the Mike Brown killing in Ferguson, other issues of police brutality. We demonstrate against the neo-Nazi party when they come to Philadelphia and things of that nature. So we're pretty much citywide, but we did start out of Temple University.
One of the things that Dr. Montero was quite conscientious about doing was bringing Temple to the community and bringing the community into Temple. How are students going to keep that tradition alive?
Well, I think that this action in and of itself has brought a lot of students, particularly in the College of Liberal Arts, into that tradition of actual struggle, kind of leaving the ivory tower of academia, actually engaging into struggle. And I think that the students will continue. We're demanding the reinstatement of Dr. Montero, but that was just one of the many demands on a list of, I think, maybe 12 demands or so that we had for Temple University, which all circled around making sure that students and the community are connecting on many different levels, you know, as far as just service, as far as occupying a space together, and how to do that respectfully and how to do that in a way that benefits both parties. So I think that students now out of this struggle are empowered more than ever to continue to go into, you know, the North Philadelphia community, because they're already there. They already live in there. They're already shopping there, eating there, doing different things. But I think that pretty much a veil has been lifted wherein students feel more empowered to make changes that are necessary in order to diminish some of the harms that the university has done. And those harms that come with gentrification are extensive and really can't be reversed by anything at this point outside of total revolution. But I think that the students are more empowered than ever to keep going out and engaging with the community in radical ways.
And the lecture series, the Du Bois lecture series, is part of that effort.
Certainly, because if you even see the turnout of the lecture series, students definitely come out, but the community comes out. And it's something so radical and something so powerful about the North Philadelphia community occupying space on Temple University's campus, which is supposed to be, you know, a public university that's open to all, but has traditionally been one that pretty much discourages community members from integrating into that space. And so when you see the number of the Black community in Philadelphia, period, the number of people from the Black community who attend the lecture series and who are there sitting next to students, you know, notebooks out, learning and engaging in that kind of learning environment, you definitely see that kind of thing going on.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. And while you're there, make plans to attend Black Agenda Report's 8th year anniversary celebration at historic Riverside Church in New York City. That's on October 24th. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.